I'm Blaise Aguirre-Yarkas. I work in the machine intelligence group at Google.
Today, I had no idea what to expect when you got up and did a talk. And it kind of happens at Thinking Digital. I get my mind blown, but I didn't expect in such a... You made a lot of very, very complicated stuff quite palatable for my brain.
Thank you. That's exactly what I'd hoped. It's really nice to hear.
And it was a lot less scary than I thought machine intelligence would be. Can you give me a summary?
Well, what are the scary bits for you? What scares you?
I've been affected by science fiction. When machines get smart, they see us as the fallible humans we are, surely. And they see us as destructive, chaotic creatures, unable to live by our own moral precepts and rules that, yes, we've invented ourselves, but we're a very, very destructive, non-sustainable force of nature, are we not?
Right, so you've just described the plot of iRobot, I suppose, right?
I did ask you, didn't I, if you read Asimov, and you said yes, all of them.
Yes, that's right. We all read a lot of science fiction as kids, right?
It affected me a lot.
Me too. I mean, who could it not have? You know, it fires the imagination, right? And it was, and I think the sci-fi of our childhoods was imaginative and optimistic about what humans could achieve in ways that there's not very much science fiction nowadays that is. But anyway, so you asked why am I not as afraid? I am afraid, by the way. I mean, I think that we have a lot of failure modes and a lot of things that we could really screw up as we do machine intelligence. But the main point that I was making at the end of the talk is that a lot of the things that we associate with the sort of Skynet failure mode of machine intelligence that we take as a sort of like Frankenstein's monster. If we bring it to life, then it's going to turn around and destroy us because we're inferior and essentially do the same thing to us that we've done to the other great apes. I don't think that follows. I think that the aggression, the ideas of dominance hierarchy, of wanting to dominate other species, wanting to consume resources, and even of wanting to survive at all costs, even those things, they don't come from the intelligence itself. They come from a place lower down in our beings, the place that evolved through Darwinian evolution.
So is... Can an optimistic yearning for a better future be programmed?
Yes. Well, I mean, things like maximizing good, you know, I think could be codified in some way. So, you know, one has to be very careful because there are a lot of science fiction plots one could imagine in which you make a seemingly good objective function that somehow there's an unexpected way of satisfying or of fulfilling, right? These scenarios have been raised even in the context of, for example, the self-driving cars that Google is making. You know, if you make the objective function minimize loss of human life, then even so, you can end up with these moral dilemma sorts of situations in which the machine does something apparently horrible, like, you know, accelerating to run over somebody. Or something like that, because if it hadn't done that, it calculated that there was such and such percent chance that three people would have been killed, and so on. So you have to be very, very thoughtful and careful about what the objectives are, what it's programmed to do. But the idea that somehow if something is intelligent enough, then it defeats its own programming or it can't be programmed, I think is wrong. We are programmed, and our intelligence is in the service of that programming. And by programming, I don't mean what is the algorithm that we use to solve problems. I mean, what are we solving problems for? What's the point? We know what the point is for us. You know, it's some mixture of things like love and hate and desire for success and desire for sex and desire for money and for power and for fame and, you know, all these things that are programmed into us at some very, very basic level. And we get to set those criteria for the intelligences that we make.
And you're confidence in that level of control makes me feel a lot better about the fact that I don't know exactly how many years, maybe you can tell me, but you will be effectively prototyping machines smarter than human beings.
Well, not me or my team. I mean, there are a number of us in machine intelligence. Actually, I think the group at Google that, in my view at least, is furthest along at a lot of really interesting aspects of this is here in the UK, DeepMind in London.
The recent acquisition.
Right, who I'm actually here to visit. So yeah, those those guys are quite wonderful. And actually, Demis Hassabis, the founder, insisted on an ethics board being formed at Google as a condition of the acquisition, because he has many of the same concerns.
It's crazy. This sounds like we're coming back to science fiction.
Yes, I think we're living science fiction now.
How different is the world going to look in the next 10 years? This is such a broad question. But from what you're saying now, I cannot begin to fathom. I'm not just talking about personal devices. I'm thinking about the intelligence that is going to live inside every network device.
Yes. So, I hesitate to put a real timeline on these things, but I think we're very close to having a lot of the things that characterize intelligence in humans on devices. And I think that, when we talk about, what are the transformations, what are the things that are changing, and there are a number of them, and I just wrote a short piece for the TED blog about a few of them that I think about. The one that I think is most closely associated with this creation of intelligent machines is economic. There are a lot of jobs, I think, and I think many people agree, that are being rendered unnecessary by machines. And in the beginning, of course, most of those jobs are jobs that are perhaps best done by machines, both because they'll do a better job of it for the rest of us, and because in many cases the labor is menial and is something that maybe humans should not be doing. But on the other hand, if so many of us are unemployed by that process, and we continue to live in a capitalist system in which there's no floor, and people are miserable and poor if they don't have employment, then I think we really have painted ourselves into a corner. So in my view, one of the consequences of the evolution of the technology, and I think the intelligent machines are really just the latest chapter in the whole evolution of technology that eliminates jobs in one way or another, and it'll continue. One consequence is that we're going to have to figure out different ways of redistributing money in such a way that nobody is left behind.
Will this have to be done before we reach that level of technological advancement?
I think it already needs to be done now. There are some countries in Scandinavia, in Europe, elsewhere, that already, I think, have schemes that are not so unlike what I think we have to move toward.
How close are these schemes to communism?
Well, communism implies central planning. I don't think that central planning has shown itself to be effective over the last 100 years. One can imagine a future in which whatever's at the center of the central planning is much smarter than the systems that have been at the center, but that's not really what I would advocate. I think that the simplest, the obvious approach is to just have a guaranteed minimum income. And if you have that, if you take a certain fraction, a large fraction of the tax base, and you redistribute it uniformly among everybody, then you've created a floor, and you could have capitalism function perfectly effectively on top of that, but nobody sinks below this subsistence level.
Wow. So we don't have to completely get rid of capitalism?
No, I don't think so. I think the easiest thing is to let capitalism be, but enforce a floor that makes sure that everybody has dignity. Jaron Lanier has argued for things like he's the inventor of the term virtual reality, and has written a book recently about this kind of stuff, Who Owns the Future. An interesting book, although I disagree with many of the premises in there. But he's argued for things like having everybody get paid for the information that they generate. So, anytime you make a tweet and that gets used somewhere else, or you submit a location data point and that gets used to improve a map, or who knows what, that everybody should get micropayments to compensate for all of that. But the fact is that I don't think the arithmetic works out. We can't get paid enough money to survive and to have a dignified life from tweeting and from shopping, passively or something, right? There needs to be just some sense that this is the baseline that humans get, and that's it.
I'm still feeling pretty optimistic.
Good.
The fact that we have to sort out society to kind of make the bed for such an incredible advanced technology, which ultimately should hopefully make human existence a lot more bearable. Not saying that it's misery now, but for many, many, many people it is.
For many people it still is misery. And I like like all of the tech, I mean, this is the same thing as the steam shovel, you know, eliminating the jobs of people who are digging, you know, in trenches all day. And it's just, it's more of that. And I think fundamentally those things are positive. It's just that, you know, if you have a whole bunch of people who used to shovel dirt and now are unable to shovel dirt because it's not economic to employ them and they have no other skill, you can't let them starve. And ultimately, that person shoveling the dirt is a great, great many of us. It's not just people with very low skill or who have, you know, emerged, you know, illiterate from poverty somewhere. It's the majority of us, perhaps. So we need to really think hard about what are our rights as humans, and not have this sort of Calvinist mentality, frankly, that if you're not doing work, you don't deserve to live.
May I be so bold as to say, I think Google has acquired a very decent, interesting, broad-minded, optimistic asset when they acquired you.
That's incredibly kind of you to say. Thank you so much.
Very much so. And I got that from your talk today, and I've got that from the snatches of conversations that we've had. So, yeah, thank you very much for sharing some time.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate it.